give a fuck.
Are you sure?
I just don't give a fuck.
Presenting The Art of Not Giving a Fuck with Garrett John.
Okay, hey everybody, this is Garrett with The Art of NGF, and welcome to another Victim to Adventurer podcast episode. Today we've got a very special guest. With us today is Sean Atwood. You can check him out at seanatwood.com, which is SHAUNATTWOOD.com. SeanAtwood.com. And rather than do a standard introduction, we're going to dive right in to Sean's story here. So briefly, Sean is now a writer and a speaker, on his way very, very soon to give a TED Talk. And we'll discuss what that's about and get into the books he's written and published. But first, Sean, I just wanted to say welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Garrett.
And thanks for being on. And let's just dive right in. Tell me about the moment that a SWAT team was kicking in your door. We'll just dive right into the deep end here.
On May 16th, 2002, I was up early on my computer, and then I heard bang, 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 bang. Look for the people. It's blacked out. I'm wondering, is it the police or is it someone trying to rob me? Look out the window. Marksmen with rifles, SWAT team, police vehicles. The whole place is surrounded. So I was about to let them in, and then just boom. Door just flies off the hinges, and all those guns open up on you, and you're thinking, you know, if they start firing, your life's over in seconds. My heart just about jumped out of my chest, but they're yelling at you to get down. So I got down right away, and then they crushed me and handcuffed me.
Wow. So there's our opening scene. Now let's back up a little bit. So there was a point where you were doing, you were doing economics and finance you were involved in?
Yeah, I started following the stock market when I was 14, made my first investment when I was 16, went on to do a business studies degree at Liverpool Uni, and then moved to Arizona because I had two aunts living out there, and I used to visit them as a kid. So it was like paradise coming from a northern town in the UK, you know, sunshine, swimming pools in backyards, palm trees, people loving the British accent. So my goal was to move out there after uni, and I did. Got work in the stock market, started from scratch, just living off my student credit cards. But over the years, it built up to the point where I was worth a couple of million in the stock market. I didn't need to be getting involved in drugs, but it was so exciting for me. That lifestyle was so addictive. I ended up making a decision that completely transformed my life. And I started to throw rave parties, and I also started to distribute ecstasy. I had people smuggling it. In the beginning, I was just hooking up my mates with it, but over the years, at the peak of it, people bringing up to 40,000 pills at a time over from Holland, and they had about 200 people working for me in the rave scene.
Wow.
So it was my own stupid fault that the SWAT team came.
And now, you said that you were nervous that it was someone, that it might have been someone else and not the police showing up.
Yeah, my competitor was Sammy the Bull Gravano, and he'd murdered almost two dozen people. And his son told me later in prison he'd been dispatched to kidnap me one night. And we'd only missed them because my mate, Wildman, had got in a scuffle and we'd had to leave that place in a hurry. So on the drugs, it was telling me, you're the man, Mr. Cool Guy, Scarface, Blow, you're living in a movie. But once that cloud had lifted out of my head in the jail after 10 years of drug use, and I looked back from a sober perspective, I was like, how on earth are you still alive?
Yeah. So what happened when they took you in?
Well, it's all completely gang controlled, isn't it? You got to get used to heads getting bashed against toilets, bodies getting thrown around. And if you're a white person, then you come under the control of the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang, mm-hmm. which are neo-Nazis. I mean, there was guys in there that one guy had a tattoo of Hitler on his chest, saluting Zeke Heil, and over, and he was watching Jews getting incinerated in the gas chamber. So this is, you know, this is the kind of environment I put myself in, and I had to learn to survive very rapidly. And it also caused me to reflect on what I'd done and come up with the most important lessons I'd learned in my life so I would not end up in that situation again.
Yeah. How did you find the motivation? I mean, what was it like inside your mind, you know, over the course of, say, the first week or two that you ended up in there?
Oh, first week or two, it's just raw survival. So everything you're thinking about today, you know, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? What are me and my partner going to do? You know, we're going to watch a movie. That kind of stuff, it's all out the window. When you're in a place where heads are getting smashed against toilets and blood's getting splashed against walls and sometimes on you, then all you can think about is who can help me in this situation and who might harm me. Mm-hmm. And I do prison survival advice videos on my YouTube channel. And one of the most important things I say, if you're not a big tough guy who wants to fight your way through it, is make alliances with the right people. Mm-hmm. That's what I did over time. Writing kind of became my currency because I never set out to be a writer. I was exposing the human rights violations in the jail. You know, guards were murdering mentally ill prisoners, dead rats in the food on occasion, cockroaches crawling all over us at night so we couldn't sleep, no sunshine for almost a year. So these human rights violations, I started to document them, got smuggled out by my aunt, put on the internet as my blog, John's Jail Journal, and that went on to attract international media attention. That's what led to me becoming a writer.
Wow. So they never discovered that it was you while you were on the inside?
No, they didn't. Not in the remand jail, no.
Yeah. Well, it's probably good you're not around any of those folks any longer.
Yeah, absolutely. I wake up with a smile on my face now because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's amazing that you were able to, I mean, how were you even able to get, so you got started with the writing, you started documenting these things, which must have given you some amount of strength and at least a solid footing of a goal, something to do.
It was completely cathartic by writing about what I was enduring. It was helping me psychologically because people started to read it from around the world and send me letters, and some sent books via Amazon. And it was like they were there with me in spirit. So these kind people restored my faith in humanity. And, you know, I'm still in touch with some of them to this day. And if any of them are listening to this, I can't express my gratitude enough.
Yeah, that's just beautiful. And that you're able to get stuff put online from on the inside is really excellent as well.
Yeah, I with a little golf pencil, I wrote on paper, and my aunt smuggled it out, and she emailed those little notes that I'd wrote up to my parents over in the UK.
Wow. That is just excellent. One of the things we talk about a lot on here is the shift in the mindset or in the perspective, like I mentioned, from victim to adventurer. And one of the ways to get from here to there, we call the spy. That's one of the models that we use to reference that. And it seems like that's just right there in your direct experience. There's the victim, which is just, oh, fuck, I'm stuck in this situation. What the hell am I going to do? And then somehow the spy gets activated. And there it was, writing these tales and slipping them out. And the spy gains ground and can remain confident even in a situation that otherwise would victimize, you know, the average person. So that's really fascinating, that aspect. Was that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I'd like to make it clear, I don't want to portray myself as a victim to any listeners in the wrong context, because I deserve to be punished. I was causing a lot of harm to society with the drugs I was importing. And if I was a victim, I was a victim of my own adventurous nature, my risk-taking nature.
Yeah.
I made those choices to get involved in criminal activity.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point, as you realize, and especially like you said, looking back, continuing down that same path without any regard for what might happen, that's that's an easy situation that a person could use to think of themselves as a victim, you know?
Yeah, and in the beginning, in the jail, I was resenting getting caught, and I was pining for my old lifestyle back. You know, at one point, I had a $1 million house on the side of the mountain with a swimming pool. I had all these cars, all these gadgets, and the addiction to the lifestyle. So for the first year, if I'd have got released that first year, I probably would have gone back to it. But what happened was, there was a turning point psychologically for me. And this might feed into what you're saying about the emergence of the spy, whereby in my second year in the remand jail, the prosecutor said, every time I spoke about drugs on the phone, carried 5 to 10 years. I had 20 plus charges. So if they took it to trial and I lost, they would stack my charges up to a maximum 200 year sentence. Wow. So when you're facing 200 years, what happens in the brain is that the $1 million house on the side of the mountain doesn't matter anymore. Your swimming pool is irrelevant. Who cares about your sports car? All you can focus on from then on is getting your life back. And getting sentenced to 9.5 years was actually one of the happiest days in my life, because I could see an end to it. I knew the exact day that I was going to get out. And when I was facing 200 years, it moved me from medium security to maximum security. I couldn't sleep with the cockroaches crawling on me every night, going in my ears, going in my mouth, tickling my hands. I had all these bleeding and itching skin infections and bed sores, pink eye infection, yellow pus coming out of my eyeball. They stopped my girlfriend from visiting me. And I'm thinking, 200 years, I can't take this for 200 years.
Yeah.
I'm gonna slash my wrists and bleed out. So I planned to slash my wrists after regarded as a security walk. And before I was gonna do it, I wanted to say goodbye to my family and friends. And what I mean by that is, I was allowed 7 photos in the jail. Mm-hmm. But I got out these photos of my mom, dad, sister, girlfriend, and I'm looking at them. I'm getting real sad. I'm thinking, mom's going to get a call saying he's slashed his wrist in an Arizona jail cell. I couldn't bear the thought of putting her through that, and that's what stopped me from doing it. But the next day, I felt silly for feeling that way, and I felt guilty and selfish, because, like I said, I'd put myself in there. And I started to pay attention to the needs of others. Prior to incarceration, my behavior had been narcissistic, hedonistic, selfish. But once I got in the jail, as I reached this turning point in the second year, I started to help people. And in the beginning, I would read people's legal paperwork, because a third of the guys in there couldn't even read or write.
Oh, wow.
You know, the media likes people to believe prisoners are all psychos, serial killers, rapers, murderers. But it was really the warehousing of non-violent drug offenders and society's most vulnerable people.
Yeah.
Low-level drug users were by far the majority of the prison population. So yeah. I started to teach the Mexicans Spanish so they could write home to their loved ones. And I felt all the more guilty because I didn't have the advantages many of those people had in life. And towards the end of it, I started to think, how can I articulate the situation? And that's what led to me writing the blog. And that it was the blog getting discovered that led to me becoming an author, which it then gave me credibility to do talks at schools. So one of the most important lessons for me to learn was to stop being selfish and just be materialistic and to start helping other people. And, you know, helping other people, it put a brake on my ego, because it was my ego unbridled that led to my own demise.
Mm-hmm. So what, now you mentioned you read over 1,000 books on the inside. How did you get access, and what led to that yearning and that part of the adventure?
In the beginning, family members were sending me books. And then as the blog gained momentum, blog readers kindly started to send books. There was a real Shawshank Redemption moment where in the prison after the jail, I was allowed 7 books in my cell. And this redneck guard with the aviator sunglasses and the chewing tobacco comes across the desert wheeling this barrow full of books And he's like, Atwood, get your ass down here. So I came down to the guard. He's like, how many books you had in your cell? I said, 7. As well, there's over 50 books in this cart. I could classify them as contraband and destroy them all. But because I know you're sharing them with the other fellas and you're donating them to the library, I'm going to look the other way and they're all going to disappear. And I just yelled at all my mates. And we grabbed these books. We were like a trail of ants going across the desert holding these books. And it was like Christmas in my cell. They were all sniffing them and running off with books. And everybody was just so happy because, you know, things like books are gold in prison.
Yeah.
I started to read at a fast rate. In 2006, I read 268 books alone. I started to write them all down and rate them as well. Mm-hmm. And I read a lot of the original texts in psychology and philosophy. And they caused me to go deep inside myself and address the root causes of why I'd got involved in drugs in the first place, and also enabled me to build a framework to deal with it all. Now, another influence on me in the prison was a guy called Two Tonys. Two Tonys was a mafia mass murderer who left the dead bodies of rival gangsters from Arizona to Alaska. He was serving 141 years. And I got in a situation with a cellmate who was a serial home invader torturer who didn't like me. And he got his mate to attack me when my parents had flown home to Christmas. I ended up getting moved out of that cell and introduced to Tonys, who came in my life as a protective force. He knew I was a writer and he was looking for someone to write his life story. And I started sneaking in his cell every day, and the respect other people harbored for him started to rub off on me. He was introducing me to them as his official biographer. But he also introduced me to contemporary authors like John Updike, Tom Wolfe. And he came into my cell one day with one of his favorite books, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Mm. Ivan's in the Russian gulag under the Stalin era. It's so cold, if you spit, your spit freezes mid-air. They're working these guys to death. If they refuse to work, they're dragged to death by horseback, they're thrown off a cliff, or they're hung off a tree. Now, whenever the prisoners complained about anything, this is another lesson I learned, was how to appreciate the small things from Two Tonys. Whenever the prisoners complained about anything, such as the breakfast is cold in the morning, Two Tonys would laugh at them and say, hey, where Ivan was at, they were fighting over a fish eyeball in the soup. How can you guys complain? You know, these guys in the Russian gulag, they were losing fingers, noses, toes. You know, they had no one to complain to. So he really put things in perspective for me about appreciating the small things. Sadly, Two Tonys died in 2010 from liver cancer from his own drug taking. But in a sense, the spirit of him lives on in me. Smile on my face now, because there are no dead rats in my food anymore. There are no cockroaches in my bed. I'm free. I'm in the West, where conditions are extremely good compared to a lot of the horrible stuff that's going on around the world. And you know, that makes it's given me a whole new appreciation of life.
Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful, man. Something Will mentioned that he wanted me to bring up was some of the art and the expression and the poetry, the things that you witnessed, expressions of beauty that you saw on the inside in jail.
The media has us believe that prisoners are just all psychopaths with playing video games and having a good old time with luxuries and stuff like that. That's not the case. Most people in there, it's to do with drugs. And drugs is the great equalizer. It brings a lot of people from different walks of life into the prison. And there's an extreme amount of talented people in there, and there's artists, there's poets, there's writers, there's what's called a prison intelligentsia, guys who are doing long sentences, they get multiple degrees, they go on these like self-study programs. But the prison in Arizona, the system, it's so draconian, they don't give these guys anything positive to channel their energy into. It's allowed to be drug and gang infested mayhem, because you know, these guys, then when they get out, they'll come right back to the prison. And the prison gets $50,000 a year of taxpayers' money per prison. It did back then anyway. That's what keeps the prison in business. These guys, these talented people, the people with the addiction issues, they're set up to fail and they come right back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's so many ways that that, you know, $50,000, if I was given that per person that I could use to, you know, help somebody overcome whatever situation, I think I can think of a huge amount of things that I would do with it before trapping them into a cell, you know?
Yeah, in the UK, you could send a young person to the top independent school in our country for less money than it costs to house someone for in a prison.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, with that amount, you could send people out on, you know, even highly protected, heavily guarded, you know, wilderness type trips, adventures, situations where they'd have to learn how to take care of each other. You know, there's all kinds of things that could be explored, you know, and that could be explored very easily. And if one thing failed, there's plenty to try with the next. It almost seems like a lack of creativity. And that's one place where we see this whole victim trip getting locked, running rampant is people are all continuing to victimize themselves with the standards of the past. You know, we all grow up and we see, okay, there's prisons, there's presidents, there's nation states, there's all these things. But there's an extreme lack of imagination and creativity of anyone even being able to think their way out of that, let alone propose something new. Like, hey, maybe this whole court thing isn't really set up the way we'd like, you know, maybe our parents were a little messed up here, or, you know what I mean? There's no, it's like a chronic victimized situation for everybody, whether you're rich or poor or not, you're still like an adherent afflicted by the models that the people before you decided to make ubiquitous.
Yes. And it won't change because the big money is on the status quo.
Right.
But I do credit saying that, I do credit it. I'm the poster child really for the prison because I'm a successful person. And I do credit it with getting me off the drugs and saving my life. And perhaps I was an aberration because I had such strong family support. I've got an education. I'm a bit of a self-starter, an entrepreneur. And all these people from around the world, these kind blog readers, were helping me. And you mentioned about the reading earlier and the takeaways. There was some. I went on this fantastic journey through literature. And there was a therapist I came into contact with in the prison called Dr. O. And he was into neuroscience and Eastern philosophy. And he knew I was reading a lot of philosophy and psychology. Uh-huh. He said, it's great that you're reading all this stuff, but how can you apply it to your life? He said, I want you to write down some quotes and bring them to me. And we'll discuss how you can apply them to your life. And I'll just like to go over three quotes because I think they might be helpful for some of the listeners if they're going through the kinds of things I've been through in my life. One of them was Friedrich Nietzsche, who's the German philosopher. He was one of my favorites. And the quote from him that I really liked was, live your life like a work of art. And what I mean by that is, look at how much effort people put into a work of art. If you put that much effort into living your life, imagine how much the quality of your life would improve. Another one was Marcus Aurelius, and he wrote a little book called Meditations, which I read over and over again in prison. It's really good for people going through turmoil. And his quote was, you know, if there's a storm at sea and the waves are coming up, be like the promenade upon which the waves lash, but you stand strong and firm with all this chaos around you. And, you know, we all go through rough patches, road of life. And if you can try and remember, fall back on quotes like that to keep that mental equanimity during those tough times. I just find people like Aurelius inspirational for tough times. And then the third one was a philosopher called Epictetus. And he said, we're not disturbed by what goes on around us, but by our thoughts, our reaction to it. I'll give you an example to that. In the prison, people all day long are calling each other names, and the people who react the most to the name calling, they get picked on the most. Mm-hmm. But according to Epictetus, it doesn't matter what anybody says to you, you have control of your reaction to it via your thoughts. You can choose to ignore it or react in a different way. And then that puts the power back into the person who's potentially going to get victimized.
Yeah. Excellent. I've seen those authors mentioned lately too. Marcus Aurelius, I'd seen the Meditations quite a few years ago, and they've come up again recently. I think people are republishing and repurposing some of the Stoic, what they call the Stoic authors, and Epictetus as well gets mentioned in that context. That's really interesting that you discovered those in that, in the flow of your experience in there.
Yeah, I still fall back on this to this day. You know, get stuck in a traffic situation, and I see people blowing gaskets in their brains because they're so frustrated because they can't move. I just went to an Indian restaurant to get a takeaway this evening, and the traffic is completely jammed. And people, I see all the commuters, like, they're just absolutely frantic because they can't get home. And then I start to, you know, and we've all been there, but if you can come in with something like one of those quotes and just makes you realize, you know, it's not the end of the world. There's mudslides in one country, there's a tsunami in another country's getting bombed, people getting blown to pieces, people are drowning, you know, getting stuck in that traffic, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, it's no big deal. And I see that a lot. And that is, in a way, that kind of ties into maybe what led you to start down the road of, well, you said you were already successful. You met with quite a bit of success on the financial level, or what's seen as successful, what's defined popularly as success. You have all that and yet decided, I mean, because you could have just as easily bought all the ecstasy you wanted and given it away to people. You know what I mean? Like it could just as easily been something where you never risked as much as you did. So in a way, it looks like from the perspective of looking back from now, it looks almost as though the path was set up in front of you. I mean, let's go back and visit that. What was it? What was going on when you decided, when you made the decision knowingly that you were going to step into this river of so much risk? In order to do that, because you didn't need it, like you said, you didn't need the money. You didn't have to put yourself in that position.
There was a transition from me working as a stockbroker, having a lot of money, showing off, buying people drugs, and handing out ecstasy pills for free. And there came a point then when I saw the business potential of it, and greed took over. And I started to apply my business studies knowledge then to building this criminal organization. And it was structured pretty much like a corporation. I had divisions, I had heads of divisions. We had a crime family dinner every so many months where the heads of divisions came. Everybody in the organization had legal benefits, whereby if they got arrested, a lawyer would be assigned to them right away. And they would get bailed out right away, and they were instructed, you know, never to speak to the police. That's what happened. And I think part of it, I've got an addictive personality type.
Mm-hmm.
When you're throwing a rave party for thousands of people, and you've got like 20 bouncers in there, effectively your bodyguards, and you've got people coming up to you all night long, hugging you, thanking you for the ecstasy and the music and the vibe. That is more addictive than the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
All that attention and the power and the feeling of, you know, being in control of all this stuff that's going on, it was way more addictive than the drugs and the money. It's mm-hmm. just that's why it's the lifestyle. It's the hardest, one of the hardest things to give up.
So what would you say, and forgive me if I'm stating it in a way you might not, but what was something missing? What was missing? Because we're all given this standard of success, and part of what my work is helping people destroy that and then discover their own, create their own, evaluate, and based on personal experience, and then develop your own definition of what success would mean, which could mean a bunch of failures. You know, in the case of art, it has to mean a ton of failed attempts along your way of learning, you know, to master anything, really. So what was missing, though? What was missing from the life of the stockbroker, you know, that has the house, that has the pool, that has the, because again, like I'm saying, you could have, could also have hosted parties and had people around and done it in such a way, like I said, where the money was still flowing from, something was drawing you toward the risk is what I'm trying to hint at here.
Exactly. Adrenaline junkie personality type that I've got wanted more excitement. And, you know, when you're running a smuggling operation and dodging the police, that's putting you on the edge of that adrenaline fix. Mm-hmm. So there's far more to it than just the money and the drugs. It's that addictive personality and the excitement associated with it. And another thing that the therapist said to me, Sean, the way to handle this addictive personality type is to view it as just energy. You are choosing to take your energy and to put it into negative addiction. You know, racing around in my sports car on crystal meth, hanging out with all these gangsters in the drug community, stuff that could have got me killed. Mm-hmm. He taught me, if you've got this addictive personality type, the key is to put your energy into positive addictions. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I do now. You know, karate is come out of a natural high. Public speaking, getting up in front of hundreds of people, doing a natural high.
Yeah.
So I've still got that personality type that led to me getting into trouble. But I've learned now by going inside myself, by taking time for introspection, how to handle it by channeling my energy into positive things.
And so would you say you see a difference now in the way, you know, how does your mind work now? Like if you, one of the hallmarks we talk about, that victim to adventurer thing, is that the victim's always doing things out of fear or avoiding or running away from, hiding from the facts of the situation rather than facing them and then being able to deal with things as they are, with the tools that you have at hand. It can feel almost like climbing up out of a hole where all the goals were fear-based and hiding out-based, and then emerging into, I mean, now you're doing a TED Talk, you're doing your books, which all have to be self-determined. Like you said, you're a self-starter, but is there a difference in the way that your mind works now, like how you think about goals and what you want to get yourself involved in?
From being a teenager, I'd watched that movie Wall Street and Greed is Good. And my goal was to make a hell of a lot of money in the stock market. And I did that, got off track, made money in ecstasy as well. And it was all materialistic. It was all structured, I think, very long range. And, you know, presently what I do now is I still have long range goals and stuff, but I'm going along with what my heart is telling me to do now.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going with this materialistic program that I had set in my brain from when I was a kid.
That's beautiful. So what would you know, a lot of the guys that end up around here listening to the podcast or doing this type of work have experienced a life where they have attained the success that they thought they should pursue. And then that is almost a worse blow than dealing with a life of massive problems, because they have attained what they thought they should want and what everyone, what the society, like you said, sets us up to attain. And then they get there and it's empty. They're not happy with it.
Yeah, it's a graveyard, isn't it? You see a lot of people that go off to university, get brilliant academic credentials, go into careers such as investment banking or law. They're working these ungodly hours for massive amounts of money, but they get burnt out. And, you know, by the time they're in their 30s, they're scratching their heads thinking, I've just spent the last 10 years, 10 prime years of my life going through this for what? What is all this money? What does it all mean? I can't take it with me at the end of the day. And I think a lot of people now, more than ever, just waking up to that, and they're going with things that their hearts are telling them to go with, and traveling the world and pursuing all kinds of quirky interests and setting up their own businesses. And I just, you know, I mix with a lot of people in London who I've come out of these high intensity careers and are doing these other things now. And some of them are entrepreneurs and I'm becoming extremely successful at what they do. But you know, they're running their own businesses and it just gives them a much greater sense of self-worth.
Yeah. That's an excellent way to go. What advice, if any, would you give to somebody who's facing a situation like that? I mean, your story itself is advice enough to stay out of the prison system as one of the options.
I think that people have got to figure out what their vocation is. And it was Aristotle who said, where the interests of yourself and the needs of the world interact, then therein lies your vocation. I think too many people are just getting jobs to make money, to get by, and you know we've all done it. And there's periods in our life when we have to do it to pay our bills and to pay our rents, and I completely understand that. But I think in the long run, it's going to swallow your soul, and people should really try to find a way to put their interest to use to make the world a better place. And you know, there's all kinds of creative ways to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I love that Aristotle quote. Thank you for mentioning it. I think that can be very useful for people. And a lot of times, I think with artists especially, and you might know from being a writer as well, that a lot of times artists will, they'll focus on their passion, but again, they'll find themselves back at a job they don't like or doing things that they don't care for because of a lack of finding out where that, well, first of all, devaluing their own artwork and their own contribution, not thinking of it as a contribution. And then second of all, not matching it up with the needs of the world.
Yeah.
You know, Stan Lee, the famous comic book artist, said that he felt like a failure for so many years, even though he was wildly successful at what he was doing. And he realized somehow down the line that it was, that he was providing such a wonderful service to everyone who was reading his books. He was providing fantasy and escape and excitement and this hero's journey and, you know, all these things that he didn't even know he was offering. He just thought, oh, these people were saying I was just a stupid comic book writer and I should have done something more professional.
That's it. It's a function of perseverance and not necessarily recording your success in terms of what your paycheck is in the present moment. I think things have got to be sacrificed. You know, I do think very long range. And if you know, if you look at the people like Robert Greene, he's got all these books out, there's all these talks, and he worked a hodgepodge of a variety of low jobs, and he credits all that period of his life as giving him information from all these different fields, which then fed into him being able to pursue his passion and to become completely successful at it. So for people who are looking, who are in regular jobs and are looking to pursue their passion, I think Robert Greene's story is very inspirational, because you know what you're doing right now might be actually setting you up for something much bigger in the future, something that will appeal to your heart.
Right. And just becoming aware that that's a possible thing to be focused on in your mind. One of the things we talk about a lot is something called imagination training. And by that, I just refer to what the hell's going on in your mind all day. And if the mind is constantly upset by all these things, and then imagining future catastrophes and revisiting past regrets, it has no time or energy to spend on, you know, active daydreaming and looking around or visiting a museum and saying, maybe I want to be a fucking painter. Yeah, let's get some paints today and watch Bob Ross or, you know, or whatever it is that that comes up when a lot of people would benefit just from putting on some Mr. Rogers Neighborhood or something like that, just getting the imagination working on anything other than this self-victim trap.
Yeah, Eckhart Tolle really touches on that in The Power of Now. People getting anchored to the past or worried about the future, but all that matters is the present, because that's all we've got. And you know, you could worry yourself all day long, and most things we worry about actually never even happen.
Yeah.
So it's a complete and utter waste of mental energy. So, you know, we all have these emotional reactions to things from time to time, but if you can build a framework in your brain that short circuits that worry process, then when your worries start to kick in, you can become the witness, look at yourself, see those worries, see what's happening from like a neutral perspective, and then this short circuit process kicks in, and you can stop it from actually getting any worse and put yourself back on track mentally. And they're techniques I use all the time.
Yeah, that's excuse me, that's excellent. Excellent. and that's some really good news, is that even in the most dire and difficult of circumstances, I mean, we're talking about your being stuck in prison facing 200 years, and yet somehow your imagination must have gotten, it just came to life in all those books and started serving you in all kinds of different ways.
Absolutely. You know, like Tony's taught me, there's always somebody worse off. One of the most inspirational authors I ever read was Viktor Frankl. He survived Auschwitz. And he said the people who lasted the long in Auschwitz, or the ones who survived and actually got out, were the ones who put meaning into their lives. Mm-hmm. They weren't giving up. They were forming little groups. They were singing songs. They were, you know, had little networks going. They just, whatever little things were available to them, they used them to put meaning into their lives. And psychologically then, you know, that enabled some of those people to actually endure the situation and get out alive.
There are some good crossovers between the prison can be a good metaphor. Obviously, in your case, you got to experience it direct, but it is the way that people feel about the life that they're living, even if it's not as extreme. And as you mentioned as well, it's interesting because it was the extremity of the situation that at least contributed to giving you such a huge wake-up call. Whereas folks on the outside may live in a mental prison of their own creating and never get a wake-up call, let alone an extreme one that forces them to do something about it.
Yep, and Tony's touched on that as well. He said, you know, the guy in his cubicle at Intel, who's just working all these years until he hits retirement, and is not really happy in his life, that person is in a mental prison. You know, they control them with stock options and pensions and all these other things. They're like the bars on the prison, the stock options and the pension that he's at risk if he leaves, you know, he might lose his pension, things like that. So yeah, absolutely.
Well, and one of the things that seemed really interesting that seemed to help you get by and probably relates to the business and the life you're working on now and the success you're enjoying now, which is that sense of making a contribution.
Yeah.
And it almost converts enemies into friends. If someone sees like, oh, this guy's genuinely wanting to contribute here, that's so disarming. You know, it's disarming of even the most fierce opposition in some ways.
Well, I saw the harm drugs cause society and I felt ashamed of putting people on the road of drug use, because in the jail, 90% shoot up heroin, crystal meth, 2/3 hepatitis C, which is slowly killing them. But I knew I couldn't change my past, but I pledged to go out and share my story with other people in the hope they wouldn't make my mistakes. And my main thing now is I go into schools. I speak at over 100 schools a year, about 20,000 students a year. Wow. Basically scare the living daylights out of them with what happened to me in the hope they won't go down that road of drugs and crime.
Yeah. No, your story is definitely an invitation into a new way of seeing your own life, and without, hopefully, without having, as you said, to go down the exact same road.
Yep.
Well, Sean, this has been an excellent show, and I'd like to invite you on again. I think there's a lot more stuff that we can get into, so if that's something you'd be interested in, I will be in touch and invite you on for another episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, all the stuff, the books, Making a Murder, Pablo, all that stuff. We could probably do a whole episode on just some of the things I've written about.
Yeah, do you want to go down the list? Just share what books you have out now, and folks can take a look at those. And then, yeah, we can do another whole episode and get into all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, My Life Story is a trilogy, and that is Party Time, Hard Time, and Prison Time. Now I'm writing a series of War on Drugs books. First one was Pablo Escobar Beyond Narcos, which has become an instant Amazon bestseller here in the UK. The second one is called American Maid, Who Killed Barry Seal, Pablo Escobar or George H.W. Bush? And Barry Seal was a CIA cocaine smuggling pilot. And there is a $50 million Hollywood movie coming out about him in September starring Tom Cruise.
Wow.
I am going to have a book out in January called Unmaking a Murderer, The Framing of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. And the money from that book is actually going to go to the lawyers for Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey, half of it. And half of it is going to go to something I've set up, whereby I donate free books to school kids and prisoners. And in the past 2 years, I've managed to donate 15,000 books to school kids and prisoners.
Oh, wow. Congratulations, man. That's beautiful. That's a great
thanks. Yeah, so yeah, my writing now, I've been researching the war on drugs for about 4 years, and I aim to have about 4 books out in that series out by the end of 2017.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a much needed area. The more information that can come out about that, the better. You know, even lately, the president has been on a spree of releasing a lot of federal drug prisoners.
Well, it's about time, because they locked all those black men up for tiny amounts of crack, gave them multiple life sentences, you know, and it's completely the racism in the justice system just blows my mind. I thought drug laws were to stop people from taking drugs because they hurt them. But no, I researching my War on Drugs series, these laws were introduced at the beginning of the last century to put black men, Mexicans, and Chinese immigrant workers in prison during economic downturns. And it was financed by the drug companies, plastics, pulp and paper, petrochemicals. They mainly didn't want hemp competing with their products. And if you look at the drug czar of the last century, Harry Anslinger, who was drug czar for decades, he was saying things like, you know, any black man on marijuana or cocaine will want to rape every white woman in sight. And and William Randolph Hearst, he all his media empire was putting out these racist stories. One story said that if he shot a black man in the heart with a regular bullet when he was on cocaine, he had superhuman strength and he wouldn't die. The police got so scared, they got bigger caliber bullets to shoot black men who had superhuman strength on cocaine with.
Oh my God.
That's why we have the drug laws we have today. Harry Anslinger, through the United Nations, said to every country in the world, if you don't subscribe to these drug laws in your country, if you don't introduce them, America won't trade with you.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. Well,
yeah.
I hope it keeps getting overturned. It seems little bits at a time.
Well, at the state level, it's being overturned because the people are disgusted with it. Almost a million arrests a year for weed. 90% possession. Proportionate amount for people of color. You know, people are sick of it. People smoking weed should not be in prison. You got people, judges, who drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes and take prescription pills, putting another type of drug user in prison. It's completely hypocritical.
Yeah, it's absurd. Totally.
It's
absurd.
A massive business model. Almost a million arrests a year. We're talking billions and billions and billions. Jobs, billions of jobs at stake.
Yeah, again, it reveals just a massive, massive lack of creativity and presence in what's going on. It seems like just a big mess of reactions, piled on reactions till nobody knows what's going on. And then the people who do have any level of awareness in it just reach in to try and snatch up whatever cash they can.
Driven by the greed of corporate interests.
Right.
Private prisons and stuff like that.
Well, I'm definitely glad you made your way out of there. And I'm absolutely certain that your efforts have helped a lot of other people stay out of there and then start to even escape the prisons in their own minds. So for that, I really thank you. It's beautiful what you're doing and that you're off to do a TED Talk coming up here soon.
Oh, well, I appreciate you letting me share my story and some of the lessons I've learned on your podcast, Garrett.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sean. And I look forward to meeting you sometime. And we'll have you back on the show again really soon.
Cheers. That would be great.
All right. Thank you very much. And folks, be sure to get on over and check out SeanAtwood.com, SeanAtwood.com. And I'll make sure also to share the TED Talk once that's out and about on the internet. I'll make sure to put that with the post as well so we can all share in that. And then folks listening, if you have any questions or specific places you'd like us to take the discussion, just write in and then next time we'll have those ready. All right. Thanks again, Sean.
Thanks, Guy. When will this be broadcast then?
We'll see. Well, let me say bye to everybody and then we'll talk a little bit at the end. So thanks again for listening and we'll talk to you guys all soon.
Thank you for listening to the Art of Not Giving a Fuck podcast. For more info, visit artofnotgivingafuck.com or radicalundoing.com.